You're listening to CKUT 90.3 FM.
The following is a previously broadcast program.
Listen to your
KUT Radio 90.3 FM in Montreal.
There is this thing. Do you realize what is? There is this thing. Do you realize
consciousness is affected?
There is this thing on. There is this thing going on. Do you realize
our consciousness is affected?
There is this thing going on.
What is called
the news brought to you live.
Welcome to the Wednesday edition of Off the Hour, right here on CKUT 90.3 FM. We are 28 days into the month of July. We are broadcasting from unceded Mohawk and Anishinaabe territory. You are tuned into The Avalanche, a special presentation of CKUT's Spoken Word Department. The Avalanche seeks to cover issues affecting those with disabilities. I'm your host, Zoe. On today's show, we have a panel of T1 International's Canadian chapter discussing the 100-year anniversary of the discovery of insulin. All that right here on CKUT 90.3 FM. You're listening to The Avalanche, where all abilities are welcome. If you'd like to get involved, you can call 514-448-4041, extension 6788, or email spokenword@ckut.ca. You can also follow us on Twitter at @avalancheckut.
Are you a tenant in Montreal? Do you have questions about your rights? Your local housing committee can help. To find the housing committee for your neighborhood or for more resources, go to www.rclalq.qc.ca.
Vaccination against COVID-19 is ongoing throughout Quebec. The combined effect of two doses ensures better efficacy of the vaccine, reducing the risk of getting and transmitting the virus. You'll also stay protected for a longer period of time. Coming to your appointment for the second dose of the vaccine is a must, whatever else is on your schedule. The second dose of vaccine is essential. A message from the Gouvernement du Québec.
Welcome back to The Avalanche on CKUT 90.3 FM. Up now is a panel of members from the Canadian chapter of T1 International, discussing the 100-year anniversary of the discovery of insulin and the state of insulin in Canada. That's up now. So, hi guys, welcome to the show. Would you mind introducing yourself and your work with T1 International?
My name is Jen Benatar. I'm from GTA, the Greater Toronto Area. I joined the Canadian chapter of T1 International in December of 2020 and very, very quickly somehow took over the co-leadership. I'm not sure how that happened, but the introduction came purely through social media, and it was a welcome group to find during the pandemic, especially because for a lot of T1Ds, the pandemic has been a very lonesome, lonely time. And to find a group of people that all believe in the same cause and are going through the same thing during the pandemic has been vital to my mental health, and I think to the others as well.
I also co-lead with Jen. My name's Brittany Braniff. I just wanted to thank you so much for having us. We're really excited to share all of our experience with you, Zoe, and all your listeners. I just wanted to mention that I've been living with type 1 diabetes for about 28 years. I was diagnosed when I was 2. I guess what brought me into insulin advocacy is that I believe the patient perspective is really invaluable, and there's nothing like lived experience. And therefore, I learned at a very young age that you need to make your voice heard and to have your story shared.
Okay, hi. I'll go next. My name's Mallory Balfour. I'm from Winnipeg, Manitoba. I've been living with type 1 diabetes for almost 3 years. I stumbled upon Canada Insulin for All and T1 International over social media. They were originally just an Ontario-based organization, and I originally messaged them to see if I could attend a few meetings and see what they were about and hopefully start a chapter in Manitoba or the Prairie provinces. But I'm still here because we just recently opened it up to Pan-Canadian, which is great. It's really nice to be a part of this group and just an advocacy group that is patient-led, which I think is really important. So yeah, thanks for having us.
Hi, I'm Joanne West. I was diagnosed with type 1 diabetes when I was 47. For people who know anything about diabetes or type 1 diabetes, they usually think of it as a diagnosis in childhood or teenage years, but it can actually happen at any age. And the largest growing segment of people diagnosed with type 1 diabetes, at least until COVID hit, was people over 30. I immediately, or very soon after I was diagnosed, got involved with T1 International. One of the founding members of T1 International is a Canadian, and when he moved back to Canada a few years ago, he started our chapter, and I just very happily found a posting for that meeting on Eventbrite, and I attended, and so it's been great for me to watch this group grow from in-person meetings that took place at the University of Toronto, right in front of the big old history of the discovery of insulin display, to this great online group now where we really have a national reach and hopefully a national influence, because the mandate of this organization is to increase access to insulin for everyone who needs it in Canada. And this is an issue which is very often overlooked. But the financial burden of having diabetes in Canada and differential access to insulin and medical devices has disadvantaged a lot of people in Canada, particularly Indigenous and First Nations people and people of color and people of low income. And it's been really important to me to lend my voice to advocating for improved access for everyone.
I'm Colleen Fuller. I'm in Vancouver. I hadn't heard about T1 International until, I guess, 2019, I think it was. I read an op-ed by the same fellow that Joanne was referring to. His name is James Elliott, and I was interested in the organization for a number of reasons. One is that I've had quite a lot of involvement in the policy arena around issues to do with insulin, both safety, effectiveness, price, and access. And I was interested in T1 also because it's not financially linked to the pharmaceutical industry and insulin manufacturers and so forth, which is one of the big problems in Canada and in other countries as well, is the relationship between large advocacy organizations like Diabetes Canada and the industry, which curtails the ability of those groups to adequately represent the interests of people who depend on insulin. And I maintain a strong interest in the organization. I've participated when I can in meetings and discussions, and I'm looking forward actually to seeing people face to face after COVID is over, if and when.
So in 2021, the world celebrates a century after the discovery of insulin. So prior to this discovery of insulin, how did people with diabetes manage their diabetes?
They didn't manage it. It was pretty much a death sentence. So I'm not sure how much detail you want to go into, but there are terrible pictures online that you can see of basically people withering away and basically being starved to death. It was basically a death sentence. People didn't live very long.
There was one physician created a Banting diet, which is essentially a low-carb, high-fat diet that's been quite popular recently. And it was a way, at least temporarily, people could get a little bit more time if they lived with that diet. I will say, because T1 International is an international organization, getting a diagnosis of type 1 diabetes is as much a death sentence now for people in other parts of the world as it was for people in the Western world before the discovery of insulin. The estimated duration of life after a diagnosis with type 1 in Canada before the discovery of insulin was a couple of years, maybe, if you were lucky. And it's the same thing for people in other parts of the world now.
I believe Type 1 International still says 1 in 2 people can still not access their insulin worldwide. In university, I actually took a medical history course where I had to write a paper about type 1 diabetes. So a Greek physician described what we now know as type 1 diabetes as the melting down of flesh and limbs into urine. And then in 300 AD, there were water tasters who diagnosed diabetes by tasting the urine of people who were suspected to have diabetes. Sweet urine equaled diabetes. That's where the word diabetes mellitus comes from. Mellitus meaning honey.
I just wanted to bounce off what Joanne said about the situation of people in mainly low income, but also a lot of middle income countries as well. The fact that 50% of people diagnosed with diabetes don't have access to insulin. It's partly because of the price, but it's the other reason is because manufacturers are not supplying those countries because they don't identify it as a lucrative market. So the issues are both price and supply. And both of those things, of course, impact access. Access is impacted in North America and Europe, mainly, well, not so much Europe, but in North America, certainly, access is impacted by price rather than supply for some people. Some people need insulin that is not easily accessed because it's not supplied by manufacturers as well.
And how have you guys seen access to insulin change over your lifetimes?
I've had diabetes for 53 years, and the issue of supply has really changed for different reasons. The main one is because of the commercialization of insulin. Insulin was, you know, really since from the discovery of insulin to probably the mid-1980s, the insulin access was really framed around issues to do with people's health and not with how much money could be made by manufacturers by selling insulin. So it's been commercialized. The insulin has become an industry. And so the decisions that are made about marketing are not based on need, but are based on the demands of investors and stockholders and so forth. Probably the point at which there was the greatest supply of insulin was in the mid-1990s, when there were probably about 30 different types of insulin. And people need different types of insulin. You need different insulin that lasts different lengths of time. You need insulin that peaks at different points through your lifetime. Your body changes, and so your the type of insulin that you need also changes. So the greater range of options that are available to people with diabetes, because they can't use any other drug except insulin. I'm talking about people with type 1. They can only use insulin. The greater range of options that are available to people, the safer they are, that has a positive impact on your quality of life and so forth. So what's happened since the mid-1990s was manufacturers moved to very aggressively remove probably about 25 or 26 different types of insulin because they were cheaper than the newer types of insulins that were introduced to the market in the 1980s. And so it was a marketing decision by the companies. It had nothing to do with the safety or quality of the insulin. It was strictly a marketing decision. And so the range of insulin now has quite significantly narrowed. And this, from my perspective, has increased the burden of diabetes on people who have this condition because the range of options that are available to them has narrowed.
So I've had diabetes for 35 years, and I was a child when I was diagnosed. And when you're a child diagnosed with diabetes, you eventually hopefully become an adult with diabetes. The insulins that I was originally put on when I was a child would never work for the life and for the body that I have now versus what I was put on then. And I do remember I was diagnosed in 1985. And at the time, there were still animal insulin available. There was pig and cow. Those were the two choices. And then there were these new insulins, which were the human synthetic insulins. I never went on the animal ones. I went straight to the synthetic. But I do remember vividly being at the hospital for sick kids and all of these different vials being introduced to my parents and I. And they explained to me exactly what the length of time and what each one of them did. The vials that I saw, there were probably 15 vials on a table. I would say today there's probably maybe 5, if that. It's really narrowed. And the problem is that when I was young and when I was diagnosed, I was told that a third of my life was gone just by having a diagnosis. So in my mind, as an 11-year-old, that meant that, okay, I'm going to die by 60. But I'm not dying by 60. I'm going to live a long, long, long life. And especially for women, our bodies change, our hormones change, and insulin changes. We need our medication that keeps us alive to change with us, not give us less choice. We need more choice.
That's a really good description.
I can't say as a relatively new diabetic, I've been diagnosed 6 years. Access to insulin probably hasn't changed over the lifetime of my diagnosis very much. But the changes that have occurred, let's say if I had been diagnosed as a child versus the time of diagnosis as an adult, it would have cost me less money to pay for the amount of insulin that I needed if I had been diagnosed in the 1980s, like Jen was, versus what it cost me to purchase my insulin today. Insulin and other supplies, right? Because we got to find a way to get the insulin into the body. So I would say that although I'm privileged enough to be able to pay for insulin out of pocket, regardless of the cost, there are probably lots of Canadians who have had diabetes for a long time, who have found it increasingly difficult to pay for insulin as the price has changed over time.
And I'll also just add, I think also having been just diagnosed 3 years ago, I haven't really personally seen a lot of change, but what I've just recently noticed is that just not even just insulin, but the technology, even compared to, I'm sure if I was diagnosed as a kid, has completely changed. And I find that there's really no choice but to move with it. If you're still doing like manual glucose test and you're injecting insulin manually and stuff like that, I find, or at least in my own experience, I find that people are like, well, why aren't you caught up with the times? You know what I mean? Why don't you have a Dexcom? Why don't you have an insulin pump? Why don't you have all these? They've offered this amazing technology for diabetics to use to make our lives easier. But I think people don't realize that with that technology comes an immense cost that we didn't sign up for, that we didn't prepare for, that we haven't been saving for our whole lives. So even just that, accessibility wise, I think, I know it's not insulin, but it's hard to not use the technology that is provided or that is available today, whether or not you can afford it, because I just find a lot of doctors and medical professionals just are like, well, you should get caught up with that, right? Why are you still using these old-fashioned techniques to care for your diabetes? So just access that way, I think, is pretty tricky as well.
Mallory, I'm like really proud of you for making informed decisions on your own that way and not being pressured into doing what's most popular or what's
But I have been pressured.
Yeah.
I do absolutely. Use all those technology, all that technology. And, thank you.
And a lot of times cost does have a huge play in that. I can't say that my access to insulin and how it's changed, like that I really remember too much about it, just because majority of it, my life with diabetes, my mom's kind of dealt with it. Being diagnosed at 2, I don't remember learning my insulin plan, learning how to calculate carbs, any of that, like that was taken on by my mom as a parent. And I kind of just, she taught me and I learned it, and it's been my second nature. I don't know anything different. I do know that I was on 2 types of insulin when I was on MDI, and now I'm on 1. But besides that, I've always taken Humalog, and I'm on Humalog still, but instead of MDI, I'm on an insulin pump. I know I accidentally took my fast acting instead of my long acting once before a track and field event, ended up in the hospital and almost needing glucagon. And now I've taken 30 units after having a very large meal, and my body's changed. It's different, the same amount of insulin, different times and different effects. So it's crazy how the body adapts.
And so currently Canada operates on a patchwork system in which access to care depends on one's province. What are the coverage for Team 1 related needs and your personal experiences in your province?
I think I can cover off a little bit of Ontario. So all of my prescriptions are currently partially covered by my work health plan. If I'm not mistaken, in Ontario, if your income is under a certain level, there are things available to you to help with the price of medications. In Ontario, we also have the assistive devices program, which you can get a new insulin pump every 5 years. And then the government also helps you pay for supplies for insulin pumps with $2,400 a year, which I don't know for anybody else, but that doesn't cover me for the whole year. It should, if everything worked out well and technology didn't have a little hiccups, but technology does, and so do bodies. And then everything else is paid for through my work, thankfully. So CGM access, which is the continuous glucose monitors that Mallory was talking about, we do not have coverage in Ontario. It was slated to be voted on and they voted it down a couple months ago. There are several provinces and territories that do have CGM or FGM, which is flash glucose monitoring, covered, but we do not in Ontario.
Okay, well, I'm from Manitoba, so a little different, but so in 2017, the Manitoba government made changes to the way that PharmaCare worked, and they lowered, I guess, the test strip policy for diabetics in Manitoba, lowering it to what the minimum recommended amount actually is. So that's what would be covered by the Manitoba government or PharmaCare. And then in 2012, they started the pediatric insulin pump program, which basically meant that if you were 18 and under, the Manitoba government would pay for an insulin pump. I believe it's once every 5 years while you're under 18. I think it was the beginning of this year, they upped it to be anyone under the age of 25. And they also included CGM coverage, which is the continuous glucose monitors. But again, you have to be under 25. So that's sort of where we stand. Insulin's covered under Manitoba PharmaCare, but there is a deductible that you have to reach before they will cover it. And depending on your household income, that deductible can be so high that you won't reach the deductible before they start to cover your medication. So for the most part, I'm lucky enough to be covered under my own private insurance through my work. So I personally have never had to worry about deductibles or PharmaCare or anything like that, but I know it's a huge issue. And with them not covering the pumps or the CGMs after the age of 25, diabetes doesn't disappear magically at any age. You will have it for the rest of your life. And I think it's silly to put an age cap on things like that, but that's basically it for Manitoba.
So in BC, we have an organization located at the University of British Columbia called the Therapeutics Initiative, and they provide an independent review of evidence, and they make recommendations to the PharmaCare program, which is what our drug plan is called, whether drug or I don't think they look at devices, but definitely drugs, whether it should be listed or not. So we have, of course, all of the insulin products, except now Lantus is no longer listed on the PharmaCare formulary because it's being replaced by Basaglar, which is a lower cost generic, which is something I absolutely 100% support. They're both the same. So, and that's good for taxpayers, obviously. They also, BC, like most provinces, I think all provinces now, do cover pork insulin, which is available in Canada, but on a special access basis. So it's called special authority in BC. I'm not sure what it's called elsewhere. So you have to have a physician who will write a prescription for you and justify the prescription because of your adverse reaction or your inability to safely use the recombinant human and analog insulins. So we have that, which is good. The province recently decided to cover Dexcom monitors, which is great. BC was one of the first provinces to cap the funding for test strips. And so they made a distinction between people who use insulin and people who don't. The majority of people who use insulin have type 2 diabetes. So they don't make a distinction between type 1 and type 2, just on the basis of insulin therapy. So if you are using insulin, I think that you are funded for, I think it's very high, something like 3,000 test strips a year or something like that. And if you don't use insulin, it's 600 test strips per year. So you can see that they're really looking at, providing a rationale in terms of funding test strips. BC is pretty much in line with most provinces when it comes to funding these things. They don't cover glucagon, which I think is not very good. And yeah, so we're pretty much in line with the rest of the country, except in terms of Basaglar, I think there are a number of other provinces that cover Basaglar and have withdrawn coverage for Glargine, which is the Lantus insulin.
Yep, Ontario just did that. In Ontario, some of the cost of insulin is covered if you are on disability, if your income is below a certain amount, or if you are over the age of 65. But otherwise, there is no coverage under our provincial PharmaCare for any type of insulin. There's a member of our group, former co-leader of our group, who shared with us at one in-person meeting before COVID that on her way to the group, she had passed by a homeless man that she had seen for a very long time at a major intersection in Toronto. And he always had a sign out saying that he was a diabetic. And at that time, she was under the insurance coverage of her parents. And when she could, at the end of a month or something, when she had some extra insulin pens left over, she would donate them to this guy that she would pass on the street. But I don't think Canadians realize that their very own country, the place where insulin was discovered, is also a place where people who need insulin can't get it. And that's terrible for people with type 2 diabetes. It leads to all sorts of health complications. Diabetes is still the leading cause of amputation of limbs in Canada. And there are people who have limbs amputated due to diabetes every day in Canada. But when it comes to type 1 diabetes, you can't go 48 hours without insulin or you die. And I don't think that the general public in Canada realizes the level of vulnerability that people have with diabetes and the difficulties with access to insulin and other medications and supportive technology that exist right now in our country.
Just to add on to what Joanne just said, we do need insulin to live, but insulin can also kill us. because if you take too much, too active, anything can happen, where if our blood sugar goes low, it's also a little bit of a death sentence there. And so limiting test strips or any kind of technology that will actually help us stay in that sweet spot where our blood sugars are supposed to be, it's imperative. Like, there are type 2 diabetics who do take insulin and they're limited. I think in Ontario, we have less than the 600 test strips that type 2s get in BC. But if they're taking insulin, they should be able to test their blood sugar whenever they want to. And so just understand that, yes, insulin keeps us alive, but it can also kill us.
Can I ask a question? Are you sure that Ontario doesn't fund people with type 2 if they're using insulin?
Test strips?
I think that they probably do. I think they followed suit. They followed BC in this regard to make the distinction based not on type, but on the type of medicine that you're being treated with.
I want to just say how important all these programs are, but also how difficult it is to get into these programs and stay on these programs. I know I've had difficulties being eligible. One, just to get a doctor to sign to allow me to be on it. You have to go to the doctor and have them see you for a certain amount of years or a certain amount of time. Often people have to be diagnosed with diabetes for a year, we've had members say, or you have to have your A1C in a certain range. And obviously there are certain parameters that need to be met, but when the overall goal is to take care of your health, to ensure better health long-term, I find it difficult to understand why it's necessary. We talk a lot about pharmacare, the Hoskins report, a prescription for pharmacare in Canada, achieving pharmacare for all. And it clearly states in there that like our patchwork system is broken. We know this. We know that 1 in 5 Canadian households can't afford their prescription drug coverage. And I don't know why we think that's acceptable. 1 in 5 Canadians either don't have coverage or they have inadequate coverage, that their public coverage isn't kicking in, so that they have to pay their 3 to 5% household income in order to meet their deductibles. So you can obviously see that, say you're a parent with type 1 diabetes, how you're more worried about putting food on the table for your family before taking your medication. So it's easy to make the decision to start rationing. I can see how this starts to become troublesome.
One thing that's missing is that issue of coverage is important. And I think that governments should cover insulin and supplies that are needed by people with diabetes. But they also should do a lot more hard bargaining with the industry, which is charging way too high a price for insulin, specifically for insulin. It doesn't cost that much to make insulin now. The technology has enabled the cost of production to really, really decline, but the prices are going up. And so we have a very weak system of price control in Canada at the federal level, and it means that the provinces have to then negotiate with manufacturers for the price that they are willing to pay to list those drugs on their provincial drug plans. And so the system is to patchwork, which is one reason we need national pharmacare, but we also need governments that have a lot stronger backbones and will beat back the industry, which is ripping people off. Insulin should not cost what it costs. It should be much. We should be paying probably $7 per 10 mil vials of insulin. And I'm not sure how that works out with pens and so on. But basically, it's an overpriced drug. It's been on the market it was discovered 100 years ago. And at this point, people are unable to access insulin because of the price. It's just ridiculous.
And how does the provincial model of healthcare impact those with T1 in terms of accessing care out of province?
So I did a little bit of research on this just because anytime I travel out of province, but I stay in Canada, I always just pack extra. So I've never really had to think too hard about this. But as far as Manitoba is concerned, it looks like you are covered by our provincial pharmacare anywhere in Canada. As long as you stay inside Canada, internationally, there is no coverage, and they suggest you purchase travel insurance to be covered in a different country. But I'm not sure about the other provinces, but I would think it would be mostly everyone is covered from their
by their provincial coverage, but I'm not too sure.
Yeah, I think that is right. The federal government convenes meetings amongst the provinces to develop agreements for reimbursement. So if I live in BC and something happens to me in Ontario, the BC Medical Services Plan will cover any needs that arise while I'm in Ontario and vice versa. And the reimbursement rates from province to province are negotiated. So they're completely uniform. So on the services side, people with diabetes are unlikely to be hampered in terms of access to services. If they're out of the country, there's been a lot of erosion, actually. The provinces will only reimburse you to a comparable cost. Whatever the cost would be in Canada, they will reimburse you if you needed the service outside of the country on an emergency basis. For medicine and medical devices, I think that Mallory is probably right, that you're covered within Canada but not outside, if you're eligible for coverage on the provincial drug plan, which is another problem.
The other thing, though, about a lot of our devices are covered by the manufacturer as well. And they have 24-hour hotlines where if you have a malfunction of some sort, they can probably get you an emergency. If you're closer to a big city, they can get you an emergency pump probably within 12 to 24 hours. I dropped my pump in a toilet in Vancouver, and I'm from Toronto, and I did not take an extra. You can actually order a travel loaner from the companies, and they will send you a travel loaner just to have as a backup. I did not do that because I was silly, and I thought being in Canada I was okay. And thankfully I was in a big city, so I got a new pump delivered to my hotel within 3 hours. So, but that's on the manufacturing side, has nothing to do with coverage by province. So
how would these conditions change if healthcare was standardized throughout the country? For example, a national standard for coverage for insulin versus the patchwork provincial system we currently have.
You're talking about a national pharmacare program. From my perspective, there would be two benefits. One, I mean, it depends on the kind of pharmacare program that's established. So that's, I guess, just a given. But if it is a really good program, then coverage of insulin and other products, medical devices, will be based on the best evidence of safety and effectiveness. And it will be universal so that there will be no out-of-pocket costs. It will be supported by the tax system. And the program, which will be the purchaser, we'll negotiate prices with manufacturers so that as taxpayers, we're not getting ripped off for high prices for these products. That's how I would look at it. And access would not be a problem.
And we know that 19% of type 1 diabetics have rationed their insulin. I believe that's the percentage that T1 International found. So even in Canada, where insulin was discovered, people are rationing their insulin. And I would hope that if pharmacare would mean that nobody would have to ration their insulin, they could follow their treatment plan exactly as was needed, which would help mitigate some of the complications that may occur later in life for some of us. And it would take the burden off of as we age, things are going to happen to us. And we are going to need more medication and more care. And if we're rationing in our youth, then that just means a higher cost to the whole country. It's not only ourselves, but to the whole country, who is basically going to take care of us. So a pharmacare bill means so much to people who need insulin to live. I think it would change people's lives. Completely change people's lives. You wouldn't have to stay in a job just so that you know you have coverage. That there's something about having to always have that in the back of your mind. You know, you have to make decisions about your life early on, especially if you are diagnosed as a child, that have major impact on your career, on your livelihood, on everything. As a child, I remember my father always saying to me, I will never be an entrepreneur. I could never own my own business. And he didn't say that because I wasn't capable of doing it. He said it because he knew that I should have medical coverage because I needed it for my life. And that just means being scared to be free, to be scared of what might happen. And I'll tell you, you know, I'm very lucky. I have a career that I have been able to work through the pandemic. I can't imagine what it would have been like at the beginning of this pandemic to be a type 1 diabetic who lost their job and didn't have coverage and was getting a whopping $2,000 from the government. What's $2,000 to a diabetic? Unfortunately, it's not much. So
I'm a type 1 diabetic with no health benefits whose income dropped to half in the beginning of the COVID pandemic. And I really worried because I have some variable expenses, very few, but my diabetes care is not a variable expense. And I can tell you, I panicked for a brief period of time. I am a really good saver and I don't spend very much money, partially my nature, but partially because I don't have backup. I don't have a way of covering the more than $10,000 a year that I spend out of pocket now just to stay alive. So if there were universal pharmacare in Canada that covered insulin, and if there was equitable access across all the provinces and territories to things like continuous glucose monitoring, on an individual level, it would greatly lift the psychological and financial burdens. But as Colleen said earlier, as a society, it would also lift a great deal of the kind of healthcare burden that we as taxpayers all face. As Jen said, we as diabetics, we either pay for what the insulin and diabetes management supplies that we need now, or we pay for it later in massive complications and much larger healthcare costs for the country. And diabetes rates, particularly looking at type 2 diabetes, are only increasing. And the billions and billions of dollars that it costs Canada every year and Canadians as a society and as individuals to manage diabetes and to treat the complications that arise would be greatly reduced with a universal pharmacare program. We could do management now and prevent expenditure later.
I also just want to add on an advocacy front, a good framework or a bad framework, it doesn't really matter. It would make advocating for ourselves 1,000 times easier to be able to come together as a group rather than always having to make sure that we're picking up other provinces and territories. If we could just all come together with the same knowledge and understanding and be on the same footing, it would just make advocating so much easier and it would just create a better stand to work with than just all coming together from other places.
One thing I would add also is that a national pharmacare program would be easier if we had a public manufacturer rather than depending on three global corporations to supply insulin at an excessive cost in Canada, if we could better control the cost of insulin if it was being produced here by a public manufacturer.
Which it used to be.
I think it's also important to note that there's a lot of individuals in Canada that are reliant on other public systems like disability systems and welfare systems because they're dependent on prescription drug coverage through those programs. They possibly could be working part-time but aren't able to get drug coverage through part-time work or full-time work and therefore aren't in the workforce because they need these other programs to manage and to live. So we could have other people living full, productive, healthy lives.
So one of your campaigns, hashtag FreeInsulin100, seeks to implement a national pharmacare which would include insulin to those that need it. Would you be able to describe this campaign and how it came about?
Gain momentum with Bill C-123 with the implementation of pharmacare, which was put forward as a private member's bill by Peter Julian. We were hoping that that would have come through as the Liberals have been promising pharmacare since 1997. It's been quite some time and still it hasn't gone through. And so we were hoping this was the year that we may be actually able to see PharmaCare for Canadians.
The hashtag #FreeInsulin100 came about as part of a meeting of our group last year as we looked ahead to the 100th anniversary of insulin and thought about how it would be important for our group to add the patient perspective to any kind of marking of that important anniversary. And the Free Insulin 100 hashtag specifically came about in that meeting, just in response to the open question, what do we want? What actually is our objective? And there was some discussion around, you know, affordable insulin and, you know, kind of more general goals. But I'll be honest, in that meeting, I said, no, I think we should have free insulin. And so our advocacy for free insulin, part of a national PharmaCare program, was really founded in that. We also designed the hashtag to play off of a research conference that was recently held in Toronto this year. Their hashtag was insulin 100. And there were going to be, and there were, international researchers were going to be presenting findings related to the management of diabetes. And that was to take place in person in Toronto. And we had started to plan some kinds of advocacy and activist kind of activities to be taking place around that meeting. Once that meeting moved online because of COVID, I think that's when we switched to trying to have a social media campaign to, again, sort of parallel that conference. But, you know, a lot of scientists, insulin manufacturers, other industry-related, diabetes-aligned organizations in Canada were going to mark the 100th anniversary of the discovery of insulin in a variety of ways. But most of them were not going to, as part of those celebrations, address the ongoing difficulties in Canada with access, the difficulties with rationing, the unevenness of access that exists in Canada that we were just talking about. And so as the only non-industry affiliated diabetes organization with a national presence in Canada, T1 International wanted to be sure to call attention to the real challenges of diabetes and that the discovery of insulin was not a solution to them.
Another proposed solution to the inaccessibility of insulin is an increase in the disability tax credit. How would this differ from a nationalized PharmaCare system?
I just want to say that if we actually had a national framework or any kind of universal healthcare, we would not need a disability tax credit for diabetics. And I'm sure for many other people who fall under the disability tax credit parameters. Yeah, if we actually had universal healthcare, which is something that a lot of Canadians who do not have health conditions think we do have, we wouldn't need a disability tax credit.
And with the disability tax credit, there are eligibility criteria. And we, as people with diabetes, have to have a relationship with a physician that is supportive. We only can access the disability tax credit via a physician. And while we have a disorder that is for a lifetime, there are lots of people who are denied the disability tax credit. They have to continually, repeatedly renew their applications. Although I know of one type 1 diabetic that now has it for a lifetime because it's a lifetime disease. Yes. Thank you,
that's
Jen.
Me.
You're the only one I know, I think.
Jen's the only one with a type 1 diabetic doctor. That's important to note, though.
Yeah, that's the other thing. I'm very lucky in that way.
And so with universal PharmaCare, with that has insulin coverage, we wouldn't need that anymore. We would we and other people with diabetes would have access to the insulin we need just because of our diagnosis and because of our need, not because we have to jump through hoops.
That's one thing that we didn't touch on when we were talking about the different provinces, though, and that is the access to endocrinologists and certified diabetes educators. In Toronto, we do have quite a few endocrinologists, but one of the lucky ones, because I found an endocrinologist who could take me who also lives with type 1 diabetes. And that means I never have to ask for anything. I don't have to beg to be seen. I don't have to beg for any kind. I don't have to ask for the disability tax credit. Everything is given to me because he understands what I'm going through. And I believe it's Manitoba that has 5 endocrinologists in the entire province right now.
So I looked it up yesterday. From what I can see, there's like a list that they release every year of all the physicians in the province and their specialties. There's actually 23 on the list. However, I would wager to say 80% of those, maybe 90 even, live or are located in Winnipeg, which is great for people who live in Winnipeg. But people need to remember there's a whole other area of the province that isn't just Winnipeg, that there is no physician coverage for lots of places in the territories. I know Saskatchewan struggles with coverage of physicians, and then Northern Manitoba is also a lot of people have to fly in or drive in, if that's accessible to them, to meet with an endocrinologist in the city. 23, that doesn't mean that they're all practicing endocrinologists, right? That's just one of the specialties that they work with. That doesn't mean that they're open to patients or accepting diabetics or other hormone disorders.
Not all endocrinologists take diabetes patients either. They may be in a different specialty.
And with that, the burden is still on the individual. And there are lots of people who live with type 1 diabetes who live with other disabilities. So the idea that individuals with type 1 diabetes or other disorders would need to have a physician be able to understand the disability tax credit and how to apply for it, it's not a single page document. For a lot of people who may have cognitive challenges, developmental challenges, it's a hurdle and it's a burden and it's a barrier to access for a lot of people. And there are people who just give up because it's a pain in the butt and their physicians are not supportive. I certainly had my endocrinologist tell me to not bother applying because the government was denying type 1 diabetics. This was a few years ago, and it would just be a waste of my time. And despite taking the form with me to the appointment, she refused to sign. So continuing to use the disability tax credit as a stopgap measure, as an alternative to implementing pharmacare, puts the burden on the individual patient, and also just fails, as Brittany said earlier, fails to follow through on the long-term promise now of the government in power to implement universal pharmacare. And honestly, to properly address the inequities in health access and the inequities in health that exist for Canadians across this country, there is no better way than a universal pharmacare.
They can't afford national pharmacare because they just pumped $100 billion into the military. That's probably one reason we're not getting it.
I mean, they can't afford not to. It's actually, if they want to save money, universal pharmacare is a huge money saver. But it does take some willingness.
It'll cost at the front end.
That's right. It's a front end cost for long-term saving. It's what we've been promised. It's what Canadians believe we already have. And almost all Canadians support it. You know, most of us are going to end up needing our healthcare system eventually. And it's a terrible surprise to find out that so much of what we assume is covered is not covered. As an adult getting type 1 diabetes, walking into the pharmacy, filling my first prescription for insulin and finding out I'm going to be paying for that out of my pocket, it was a terrible shock. And it's a shock that happens over and over and over again. Canadians want universal pharmacare, and Canadians believe that people who use insulin should be able to get it for free.
They actually think we get it. I had a conversation with a friend yesterday about this show, and he had thought that all of these years that he's known me that insulin is covered. So not only do people outside of Canada believe that we have that because we're like the only high income country with a universal healthcare system without pharmacare, people within the country think that diabetics get insulin.
So insulin, unlike many other medications, does not have a generic version. How does this impact accessibility?
There is one generic insulin. which is Basaglar, which is being now included in provincial formularies. You're right. There's one of the tactics that has been used very successfully by the industry is to use a process called evergreening. They evergreen their patents. So they, for example, Sanofi, which makes Lantus insulin, has continued to make Lantus insulin, but they make it in different formulations, for example. They provide the insulin through different types of devices like pens and so forth and so on. All of these things help them extend the patent. And as long as the patent is active, it is not possible to introduce a generic version of the drug. So it's not a fair playing field in any sense of the word. It's tilted in favor of manufacturers, and the cost burden on people who require insulin is very, very high. For that reason, there are steps that the government could take, but we're part of an international patent system. And so it would mean not only would they take the industry on within Canada, but they also would take the industry on an international basis because of the patent regime.
So just for your information, Lantus insulin is a long-acting insulin. And those of us who wear insulin pumps, we don't need a long-acting insulin any longer. We use a rapid insulin. So the insulin pump actually is giving you a short lifespan, very short-acting insulin on a regular basis, like throughout the day. And so you no longer need to take that long-acting insulin. But people who are on multiple injections daily, they'll need a long-acting insulin as well as a short-acting. So right now, as Colleen said, the only insulin that has a generic version is long-acting.
And thank you for correcting me, Colleen. I wasn't aware of that.
I don't have much else to say other than I am paying attention to my American brothers and sisters freaking out about the Walmart insulin. I don't know enough about what's happening there and the version that Walmart is going to be selling, but I know people are not very happy about it. But other than that, I don't have much to say about a generic version of an insulin.
So your organization has talked extensively about...
Okay, I gotta let you go. I have to get my Lake Magog vaccine.
Your Lake Magog vaccine?
Yeah, you know, I'm really looking forward to having the whole family to the cottage for my annual cookout.
Smart move. I'm gonna ask for the Montreal vaccine. I miss those last-minute get-togethers with my buddies.
Nice. Well, I gotta run. I don't think it protects against lateness.
Each vaccination brings us closer to these moments. Follow the vaccination sequence planned for your area and book an appointment at quebec.ca/COVID vaccine. A message from the gouvernement du Québec.
There is this thing. Do you realize what is? There is this thing. Do you realize
consciousness is affected?
There is this thing on. There is this thing going on. Do you realize
our consciousness is affected?
There is this thing going on.
What is called
the news brought to you live.
Welcome back to The Avalanche on CKET 90.3 FM. You are just listening to a panel of T1 International members from the Canadian chapter discussing the 100-year anniversary of the discovery of insulin. That was part one of this panel. Part two will be airing next week, August 4th. And that completes this episode of The Avalanche, a special edition of Off the Hour, airing every Wednesday from 5 to 6. To stay up to date with Avalanche news, check out our Twitter, at AvalancheCKUT. Thank yous are due to all those who make educational and inspirational radio here at CKUT possible. If you would like more information on anything you heard tonight, or would like to participate or support news produced by and for the Montreal community, please contact The Avalanche at avalancheckut.ca or CKUT's Community News Department at 514-448-4041, or contact CKUT's Spoken Word Department at 514-448-4041, extension 6788, or email spokenword@ckut.ca. Stay tuned for Jose. That's up next.
If it appears that COVID-19 symptoms like cough, fever, sore throat, and loss of taste and smell are beginning to present themselves, you can begin to self-isolate and take a rapid test at home. After getting your test results, you can learn more about proper self-isolation guidelines by visiting quebec.ca/self-isolating. This information is there to help protect you and everyone living under the same roof. All of us can make a difference, so let's keep making sure all of us are safe. A message from the gouvernement du Québec.